Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen. Still at GDC in San Francisco, my name is Kirk Hamilton, and I am joined by Jason Schreier.
Hello, Kirk.
Hello, Jason. Nice to see you. We have two guests in the room with us today. One of them is Nels Anderson, creative director at Caledonia. Hey, Nels.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Great.
Awesome. Did you know that there's a Nels Anderson who was an early American sociologist who studied hobos. Urban culture, and work culture?
Oh, I am intimately familiar.
I can tell Jason has a Wikipedia page open right now.
There's a library at the University of New Brunswick named after that Nels Anderson.
Good stuff.
That's very exciting. Our other guest is Lindsay Gallant, art director at Caledonia. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Welcome to Split Screen.
Yeah. So we should hear a little bit about what you guys have done, since I'm guessing that most people have not heard of Caledonia, since it's a brand new studio.
So fresh.
So, Nels, you want to start off and tell us a little bit about the games you have worked on?
Yep. So most recently, I helped create a game called Firewatch.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it. I don't know what that is.
It's some, like, you're in the woods out hiking simulator garbage.
I don't know.
It's boring. That was obviously very awesome. Working with those guys was all fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, both good friends and extremely talented people. And their next game, In the Valley of Gods, is also going to be really good.
Nice play.
Super cool.
It's going to be cool to see a thing that they built that I was not in the face of the entire time.
You won't be sick of it by the time you
Correct.
Play.
You can just be a fan.
Yeah, you can enjoy it.
And then before that, I was the lead designer on a 2D side-scrolling stealth game called Mark of the Ninja.
Yeah.
Which is apparently getting a re-release very soon.
I like that you say apparently.
Apparently. Just found out about it.
I discovered just slightly before the announcement, because I don't work at Clay anymore. It's fine.
Right. Yes. Right.
But yeah, it's cool. I'm glad that it will be at least on Switch. Maybe some other things too.
Really cool game. Really enjoyable.
Well, thank you.
Really smartly designed stealth game. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But Lindsay, tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah. So I come from a mobile development background, which you don't hear that much these days. Uh-huh. So I had started kind of doing premium games when that was more of a thing that actually happened, and moved into freemium. I worked at a studio called XMG, where we basically made like fashion games that were sort of light Photoshop for teenage girls, which was a cool experience, and having like millions of people play your games. But it wasn't really the type of games that I got into the game industry for. Playing like really nerdy RPGs and strategy games and shooters my whole life.
Yeah.
When I was playing extremely competitive Counter-Strike, my dream was not to make fashion games.
Although I will say, teenage girl is a very underserved demographic.
It is so true and so sad.
Yeah.
And I hope to be able to rectify that a little bit someday.
Yeah.
So I'd done mobile development for 5 years, and then I suddenly quit with almost no plan because I was tired of making mobile games. So then I had done freelance art direction for a couple of years, mostly working with indie studios in Toronto. Basically, I would just do quick contracts and do really high-level art direction type stuff. Mm-hmm. And that sort of brought me into the wheelhouse of how me and Nels met. I had worked with someone at a studio previously who Gordon McLattery, who's an awesome dude, has worked on a variety of really, really cool games. And he kind of put us in contact with each other, and now we're starting up this new studio.
Yeah. Man, so you guys were just telling us that last year you both almost quit the video game industry.
Yeah. It was for a lot of people, just because of the state of the world, 2017, not best year, not the greatest one.
Not the greatest.
Personally, also, it was not great because, like, I'd finished doing stuff with Campo, and ultimately where they decided their interest was going was just not, like, making Firewatch was awesome. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a very interesting game to make. But for me, just in terms of, like, the player experience, ultimately what's going to be manifest in the Valley of Gods is, like, you can trace the through line between Firewatch and that, like, pretty closely, right? Like, first-person story-based narrative exploration game, which is cool. But in terms of player experience, it's, like, quite similar, and I didn't really want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I opted to go off and do my own thing. I've had this idea for a different type of game that is about narrative in kind of another way. But I was having difficulty, like, finding people to work on, and like we'd applied for some funds for the Canadian government, but that, I shouldn't say we, it was just me at that point. Mm-hmm. That got rejected once, so I was just kind of in this like weird, not great place with a bunch of personal stuff, and I'm like, is this actually what I want to be do? Because it's like the thing I'd wanted to do for ages, right? Like I've been doing it for, at that point, like a decade?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, around.
But it got to the point where it's like, maybe I'm actually going to run for office?
Really?
Like maybe. I was seriously considering
Wow, that's
it.
Really interesting.
Yeah, it's like, maybe I'll be a member of our provincial legislature, maybe? Because it's all old people who don't
so
understand
you're in
anything.
Vancouver. I don't think
yeah,
you
yeah,
said
yeah.
that.
Yes. Yeah, I'm in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And then it was weird not...
Huh.
It was a weird time, and then... I was,
that's
I
mean, so
I was,
interesting. So were you actually seriously like thinking, like looking into what it would be like and like what
yeah,
you would
like
to
like,
do?
Yeah, I mean, like I become pretty politically involved with the big old lefty party up in British Columbia, uh-huh. the New Democrats for any Canadians who are listening. Mm-hmm. And it's like I'd met them. I'd done a bunch of like organizing and stuff like that. And I was like, maybe this is because it's like it's still it's a thing that's interesting and kind of appealing. And I'm like, oh, God, maybe... what am I going to do? I don't really know, but I was still pursuing like some of the game stuff for through the Canadian government anyway. And then they happened to approve, like basically it's this funding program called the CMF, the Canadian Media Fund. You can submit any project to them twice. Mm-hmm. So submitted it once, got rejected. They do two intakes per year, and they're like 6 months apart. So it's like 6 months of just like, oh God, do I even bother to like submit again? And that second application came in real hot. Like I was uploading documents, like looking at the clock and like go, I'm like, okay, the office is in Toronto and you have to submit by midnight, so that's like by 9 p.m. so I'm like 8:45 I'm uploading files and I'm just like I don't think there's any typos in here, and then you submit it.
Spoken like a true game developer.
I mean, yeah, that's how everyone does it, so don't feel too bad.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
So that came in real hot, and then even after you submit you still have to wait like 2 or 3 months, so it was just like this year-long period of like not really knowing what I'm going to be doing next, and I was like trying to do this small side project that wasn't really working out super well. It was just like this horrible existential crisis of like, this thing that I love, am I still supposed to be doing it? It was really crazy. And then thank God they approved the second application, and then that enabled me to actually start talking to other people seriously. I was at PAX eating Thai food with Gord, just because I'd been also sweat. I mean, not to talk you up or anything, yeah. But like finding an actual like art director is a very, especially at like an indie scale, is very very difficult, right?
Oh,
like there's
imagine.
Lots of like extremely talented artists, but they're often used to working with like a lot of pretty specific direction,
right?
Where it's like I need something that basically does this, mm-hmm. and of course you get it back, and it's like 10 times more amazing than you could have possibly imagined, huh. Right? But my background isn't super visual, and the game we're working on now is like, what is it going to look like? And I was like, yes, what is it going to look like? I don't know. So you have you have to find somebody who can do that. I remember like probably about a year ago, I had lunch with another Vancouver dev, Chris Barassa, who's the art director dude at Red Hook, who made Darkest Dungeon.
Oh, okay.
Obviously,
that's a
very striking, iconic looking game, right?
Yeah.
So I had lunch with Chris, and I was like, Chris, how do I clone you? I need you, and I don't know anybody else. So anyway, I was eating pretty pad Thai with Gord, and I was like, Gord, I don't know how I'm going to find this art director, such a specific role. I need someone who's really, like, really forward and, like, assertive with ideas and be a big creative collaborator. And he's like, I worked with this lady in Toronto, like, 3 or 4 years ago on this weird project. She was really good. I don't know. I'll put you guys in touch over email.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where, like, things actually got good. And I was like, oh, thank God. Never mind. No, I just need... And also, another former Kotaku split-string guest, my buddy Brett Duville.
Yes.
He'd finished helping Steve Gaynor ship Tacoma.
Yes.
And so I was kind of like, hey, Brett, what are you doing right now? You want like a weird video game?
Uh-huh.
He was like, maybe I do. He'd actually been in Portland for the Tacoma launch party.
Yeah,
he came
I
up
saw
to
him there.
Seattle to see his podcast co-host buddy, Tim Longo. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, Brett, if I buy you a train ticket, do you just want to come up over the border real quick? We could have lunch and maybe talk about some stuff?
Yes.
And then fortunately, he was like, okay, this all sounds really good. And I was able to be like, oh, okay, twist the arm. I got in touch with Lindsay. And then once those things were in place, I was like, oh, no, the problem wasn't not that I don't want to make games. The problem was just that, like, I can't work by myself. And if I try to do that, I will go mad. And it will just be... Yeah, so it's like, as soon as those pieces were placed, I was like, oh, no, never mind. Thank God. This is exactly the game I want to make. These are the people I want to make it with. Oh, okay, fine. An existential crisis resolved. Everything's good now.
Fun fact, so Brett and Tim, their podcast, Dev Game Club, which I enjoy quite a bit.
It's very
good. Always, at the end, they always do these mailbags and shout-out reviews and whatever. And every single time, they're always like... It's always someone who's like, oh, I heard about you on Kotaku Split Screen. I heard about you. And they're always like, we have to put a nickel on the jar every time. It's like Kirk and Jason. So I think they owe us a bunch of money. Lindsay, so were you were also like considering leaving.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's okay. Funny because it was the thing that me and Nelson talked about, but it's like we had put the breadcrumbs out so gingerly, like it's this very sacrilegious thing to be like, oh, maybe not games, because like I had wanted to be an artist in games since I was like 7 years old. I had like the old Warcraft 1 instruction booklet back when those were still physical.
Hell yeah.
And it had a bunch of like Chris Metzen's old graphite drawings of trolls and stuff like that. And I remember looking at it and just asking my dad, like, what are these? And I was enamored with them. And he said, oh, it's someone's job to design what these characters look like. And I was obsessed with Warcraft. So I just said at that moment, like at 7 years old, oh, that's what I want to do when I grow up.
That's
and obviously,
awesome.
Like, I feel so, so grateful that, like, my current job is my dream. And I made that, and it's amazing. But there's so much complicated trappings of when it becomes part of your identity and when you have all these assumptions about what it is and why you're doing it and what you can be. And there's always going to be a bit of a schism with reality for what you want and what it is.
Right.
And so, like, I'm so grateful for the jobs I had in mobile. But like I mentioned before, that wasn't really why I had gotten into the industry. And I had so many good learnings and takeaways, and I met a slew of absolutely wonderful people. But there's a point where you're like, is this what I got into this for? Is this what I actually wanted? And why are things not really syncing up with the reality of what my hopes were? And I think I had a similar thing with Nels, that like, I really like people a lot and I really like working with people. And being freelance is often like being in your apartment by yourself a whole lot. And so like a system that we do with Caledonia, which is like borrowed a bit from Campo Santo.
100%.
Borrowed is a generous term.
Stolen.
Straight up lifted. Sorry, guys. Is that we do like a virtual office. So when we log on in the morning to work, we just turn on a webcam.
That's cool.
And at first I was like, yo, that's a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the first day, I was like, I don't know how I haven't always been working this way.
That's so interesting.
Yeah,
so you're all on Skype. All three of you are just on Skype.
Yeah, all the time.
Mm-hmm, that's so interesting.
And it's so much better because then you don't have to like type out like annotated notes and like, here's what this image is supposed to be.
Yeah,
like you can just put on your mic and say like, hey, let's talk about stuff. And like the nature of game dev is so collaborative and so sharing, like especially on a really, really small team like ours where we have three core people, like we're all kind of thinking about all facets all the time. And each of us is the gatekeeper of kind of our own realm of expertise. But it's so important just to be able to talk about it. And I think it's a really important thing that, like, it's so normal to have doubts, and it's okay to have doubts about, like, this career, especially when so many of us put every facet of our lives and identity into game dev. So it's like, I don't know, I just feel like we should all feel more okay about, like, having doubts and understanding that, like, things are going to be good sometimes and they're not going to be good sometimes, and it's okay to, like, fight for wanting to have things be better.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, it's not some shameful admission to say, oh, I thought about not doing this for a while, especially when there are a lot of perfectly valid reasons to think about not doing something.
Totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Lindsay, I'm curious. So, you came in. So, Nels needed an art director.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, I want it to look like whatever. Like, how do you even start the whole process of creating a visual look for a game?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Did Nels come to you and say, I want it to look like Darkest Dungeon or what?
No, Nels actually had like very little input. So, I mean, you have good ideas about visual stuff, but there was not like a preconception about what it had to be, which as an art director is both immensely exciting and extremely terrifying.
Yeah.
Because when there's no constraints, like you have constraints based on what the game design is, their practical applications of stuff.
Sure.
But yeah, it was basically just like, so to speak, a very blank open canvas.
There's nothing
on
scarier
everything.
To an artist than a blank piece
totally.
Of paper.
Totally. Like,
or a writer.
I love constraints.
Yeah.
Constraints are great because sometimes knowing what you don't want is just as important as knowing what you do want.
Well, you do have constraints because you're not going to have a team of 400 people making you polygons.
Most definitely. And like, obviously that's a big part of it. So really where we kind of start is just looking at both games and like movies and art that are sort of representative of aesthetics that we would like.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of just pulling together mood boards and essentially getting like hundreds and hundreds of images that are like crazy wallpapered on everything, just to figure out like what kind of vibes of things are working and what things aren't. And really a lot of early art direction is just throwing so much stuff at the wall.
Interesting.
Just taking so many cracks at everything, doing hundreds of sketches, doing hundreds of tests, and like talking about it a lot and talking about it with like the smart people on your team and being open, especially to the fact that like, the people who are playing your game are not going to be artists. And I think a lot of artists maybe have a little bit more trouble, like myself included, differentiating that. That like art you make for artists and art you make for 99.9% of players are going to be really, really different. So there's so much utility. And like, even though, you know, Nels has a game design and programming background and Brett has a programming background, like I so value their opinions on the artistic direction of everything. So it's really like, kind of everyone collaborates on communicating exactly what everything is going to be. Yeah. But it's just iterating forever.
Yeah, and a big part of that process, too, was getting everybody on the same page with, like, the player experience, emotional, aesthetic goals, whatever. So it's kind of like, so we know both design-wise and also visually, like, what is this game actually about and what is it meant to communicate, right? Because, like, trying to design a game that is fun, it's like, well, that's unevaluable, right? That's nonsense. Like, what does that even mean? But a game that's, like, stressful, or a game that's like enlivening, or a game that's like joyous or buoyant or whatever. It's like those things you can say, like, oh, is this like kind of whimsical? That's a thing you can evaluate. Is it fun? That's meaningless, right?
So what's the answer for you guys? What is
I mean,
it's going to be really fun.
It's going to be really fun.
It's going to be really good.
That is the thing we focus on a lot, is just like, what do we want the player to feel from this? Because so much of art...
What do you want the player to feel from your game? I guess you're not talking about it.
We gotta be coy.
So you can't even say like the genre of the game. You won't say anything.
I mean, at a very high level, it's like, it's a focus on like emergent narratives. That's kind of like the toe
so
I put in the
water. Stories that are created from the player and the systems and
exactly. Yeah. So like, probably surprising nobody given the stuff that I care about. Like, it's a very crunchy systems-y game, but bent toward the purpose of using all that stuff to generate unique, compelling player stories.
Cool.
So we want to talk a little bit about Mark of the Ninja. I'm racking my brain remembering the game because I last played it in 2011 when it came out, or 2010 whenever it came out. But I remember the stealth mechanics were very transparent and very interesting.
Yes.
Tell me what it's like to design a stealth game and the types of decisions that you have to make when you're like going through that process of being like, what do we tell the player? What do we not tell the player? How do we make it like visually interesting and visually recognizable what they can and can't do without making it super easy? Those sort of questions, I imagine, are very tough to answer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting that like part of this was maybe subconscious or instinctual or whatever, because really where Ninja began was me just writing a love letter to Thief, where it's like, I love this game so much.
That's what every stealth game that's been made in the last like 10 years.
So the design basically was like, dear Thief, I love you.
You are the best. Can we go out? Check yes or no.
And Thief is like, no.
No.
Damn it.
Sorry.
I'm taken. But part of that was also kind of the core, the heart of stealth games and why they're very different from, you know, other character-based action-adventure games, whatever that means, right, is like they're all very proactive, where almost all other character-based games are reactive, right? Like you're playing an Uncharted or whatever, you know, you walk over a trigger volume, a bunch of dudes spawn, they're going to try to waste you. But stealth games, just kind of by virtue of their very nature, like the game doesn't know where you are. That's literally the definition of them, right? So the player experience is all about like, it sounds kind of a bit cheesy, but it was actually a useful tool where there's like this basically cycle of player behavior where you like observe the environment, you come up with some kind of plan to achieve what you want based on the objects in the environment and the enemies and like your own personal play style, how comfortable you are with like wasting dudes versus being all sneaky, and if you're doing a ghost run, blah, 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 blah. You come up with your plan, you attempt to execute it, and then you react to what happened.
OPER, observe, plan, execute, react.
Wow.
There's
you could be a South by Southwest speaker.
OPFR, observe, plan, fuck it up, react. That's what I do. That's how I play stealth.
We play stealth games the same way.
OPR, observe, plan, fuck it up, reload.
Reload.
That's how I play Dishonored.
Quick start, down, restart.
That stands for F9.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was kind of like, okay, well, that cycle is the beating heart of stealth games, right? Like, that's actually the thing that makes them distinct and compelling. So then everything was about, okay, well, how can we get people to that point as quickly as possible? So one of the things, just like a microcosm example of this, is in Ninja, whenever you pull that left trigger to aim, the entire game world pauses, right?
Right.
And the reason for that is because we didn't want the execution part of that, like, player behavior cycle to be reliant on dexterity because it's just kind of like, that's not actually interesting, right? When you're like, I want to do this because I'm going to shoot that light up there and then that dude's going to turn so I can drop over here and go this. Yep. But if you miss the thing, right. It's like, it's not that your plan was bad.
Right.
It's that your hands on the buttons couldn't do the thing.
Right.
Right.
That was an interesting thing I noticed in Dishonored, which I think came out after Mark of the Ninja.
Yeah.
It did. You're like, oh yeah, they stole everything.
That was 2012.
But I remember in Dishonored to the first DLC for that game, the difference in the blink mechanic, which is like the killer teleport, you know, mechanic, is that in the DLC, when you activate it, you freeze in midair, and you have the opportunity to aim. And then down the road, now Death of the Outsiders come out. In that game, I don't think you freeze in the air. Maybe there's an ability that lets you do that when you do your teleport, but you can also pause time with the scouting thing. So there's all these ways of freezing time, and it's very, very similar.
Yeah,
That's interesting that you put it that way, because you guys kind of did it first, but it's the same sort of idea.
You're welcome, Harvey. But that is just a microcosm of, it's like, okay, the aiming part, especially in the 2D game where, like, aiming is a little bit precise and, you know, basically your previous shots are effectively tracers. Like, when you play Mega Man, the fact you're jamming the shoot button over and over again is not just how that game works. That's also just kind of how you aim in a side-scroller, right? So it's like, okay, well, the precision aiming, it's like, that's not an interesting part of the dynamics of this game. So let's just get rid of that, right? And similarly with, like, all the pushing as much visual information onto the screen as possible. It's like, you know, people having to internalize how far enemies can see based on their vision, so then it's like this big trial and error thing. It's like, that's also not the interesting part. So
it's kind of an art direction question, right? I mean, I don't know, like, if this is in stealth games in general, like, you have to sort of read what's happening. You have to, like, the player has to be able to see and differentiate so many different things all at once and be able to make this plan. Is this something that you have thought about?
Oh, definitely.
In the past?
I mean, kind of a big thing in art direction for games is that certainly the art has to look pretty. That's definitely a big part of it. But visual hierarchy is a term that gets thrown around a lot. And it's basically that the player should notice things that matter in the order that they matter. That's where anyone who says, like, oh, really good UI is UI you don't notice, that's kind of, I don't know if I agree with that. But that's kind of where that adage comes from. So definitely.
Or you don't think about.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it shouldn't be taking up your brain real estate when you're trying to figure out how to, like, sneak up on
Final
some
Fantasy 15.
Lots of big opinions over here.
Games like that, yeah.
Well, Final Fantasy games are all about excess, too,
right?
In every way.
Yeah, in every way. And it's obviously, there's so many games where, like, they don't have the best visual hierarchy and it doesn't matter because there's so many facets to what games are.
Right.
But, yeah, definitely. It's a very, very astute observation that it's, like, visual hierarchy is so important with stealth games and just knowing what you need to look at and in what order and being aware of everything around your character, because obviously they're not the kind of games where they can be text heavy alerts on what is happening. So definitely.
Yeah, but it's interesting because, like, in Mark of the Ninja, you could see, like, you could visualize the noise you were making and the lights and the cones, and it's tricky to Mark of the Ninja. I think did a really good job of making it. Which, by the way, Mark of the Ninja came out September 2012. Dishonored was October 2012. Just looked it up. So only a month difference.
So, but the DLC for Dishonored, where they stole the thing from. Yeah. Mark of the Ninja came out significantly later.
Exactly. But anyway, so I was going to say that, like, the having all that information also risks making the game too easy, which I think is an interesting challenge. It's like, how do you decide, like, which information to give the player, which information not to give the player, which to keep from them?
Is there any information that Mark of the Ninja keeps from you? I'm actually trying to think.
I don't think so.
I think
you see everything.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to make all that stuff pretty opaque and overt, just because it's like, when you're doing that, it's just a question of where you want to place the difficulty and what stuff the player is actively needing to consider, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think... I mean, Ninja's not like a meat grinder murder game. You know, it's no Meat Boy or Celeste or whatever.
Right.
But where the difficulty... We got a lot more, I think, opportunity to play with some of the difficulty in the encounters and the levels and stuff because the challenge wasn't being derived from just people having to internalize how the game systems work.
Right.
We can be like, okay, we'll just kind of take it as read that people are going to get how these elements function. So now we can combine them in a way that's probably more complicated than even most other stealth games can, just because they're so confined by... I mean, also, just by virtue of being in 3D space, that also just makes things one whole D more complicated.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But it also... gives them kind of less opportunity to play with the elements of their challenges, just because understanding the challenges at all is so much.
I find that, man, I totally find that in, I was revisiting a piece I wrote about Battlefield 1 and how that game is this sort of nightmare experience for me, because I didn't really play that many Battlefield games. Then playing it, talk about readability. That game is super unreadable, I think, on purpose. And when you're playing it, you know, you run into the field and it's everything is exploding. The world is on fire. There's smoke everywhere. There's particle effects blowing up on your screen. Everyone is just like a green dude somewhere. Right. You're getting shot in like four different directions, and you usually just get killed. And it's kind of...
That's war, man.
It's really effective. It feels like war. Like, that was sort of my point, and was saying, you know, people have criticized this. Oh, it's like not super clean. It's like the opposite of Overwatch, right? Yeah. Where enemies are outlined and super clear and like high contrast. But it is effective for the game that they were making. So there's this kind of whole spectrum of that.
Well, that's the question, what you guys were saying before, is like, what do you want to evoke from the player? And it's like, you might want the chaos of war, or you might want
like
the cleanness.
Like super clean
of
power of like a ninjas. Yeah.
So I'm curious, switching the subject a little bit, I have a question for you, Lindsay. So you were in mobile game development for a while. Were you an art director at your studio?
I was. Okay. So I climbed that ladder. Nice. So I started out kind of like a junior UI artist, and then like generalist production, and then I was a lead artist, which was basically our studio had a bunch of smaller teams, so I was leading one of the smaller teams, and then I was promoted to art director from there.
First of all, it's funny that UI artist always seems to be like the bottom of the totem pole. It's what nobody wants to do. It's a bummer.
So many artists think that they don't like UI, and myself very much included, that it was like being in UI jail at first. I got to do the typography. But it's such a... I find it such an interesting confluence of like game design and art to do UI, because it's really just problem solving. And really, all art is problem solving. It's not a magical, mysterious thing. It's just formula based. Like, there's a sequence of operations to do things. And UI is really an extension of that. And it's funny because I've really found, especially working on indie teams where we all do a lot of jobs because there's not very many of us, because budgets, you kind of realize that the boundaries between different types of art and even different types of roles on games, they're all very similar. Like, I don't really mind what subject matter I'm working on, whether it's a character or a background or UI. Like, it's all problem solving for the final process of communicating what we want to communicate to the player.
Sure.
So it kind of all feels similar to me now. Yeah.
So the question I was going to ask... The question I was going to ask is, what was the transition like going from designing games, art directing games for mobile for an audience of teenage girls to suddenly, like, more PC heavy, like hardcore gaming crowd, for lack of a better word?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like the core gaming audience. Like, what is that transition like? Is it similar? Is it a similar approach, or is it just totally different headspace?
It's somewhat similar. A big thing is that I found that I could actually draw upon my experiences as a gamer working in more PC games and stuff. That like I could relate it to my own life and games that I had played. Whereas like I didn't really grow up playing like Flash web games or anything like that.
Right.
So that was a really huge thing. Is I felt like my years of training as a gamer growing up,
finally, I can
use these skills I've been
honing. It's like that Far Side cartoon where the parents are, it's like in the 90s, the parents are looking at a kid playing Nintendo and they're picturing like classified ads, like must be Nintendo expert. $80,000 a year playing Nintendo all day.
They were just like 30 years behind their time.
Exactly. I mean,
how many of us have looked at that comic and been like, though? We did it, y'all.
It worked out.
Yeah, so that's definitely a big thing, is that like I feel like my experiences as a gamer are much more applicable to my day-to-day job now.
That's so funny. It's funny to imagine and shed some light on this, like what it's like going into a game and being like, man, I have no frame of reference here at all because I've never played any of these games, like for the as far as designing mobile stuff.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and that was, I'm grateful to the company I worked at, because I'm very honest during interviews, and they had asked me what mobile games I played, and I was like, oh, none, actually. And they were like, that's fine, you'll play them, don't worry about it, which was very cool of them, because I didn't want to go in on like a false precedent or anything like that.
That's probably wise.
So I mean, I just did a bunch of research and played a lot of it and sort of looked at things analytically, which I still do with all games to an extent. Sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there. A big thing too is that in that time when I was working in mobile, a lot of it was like freemium games. So it's like the free games that you play, and then there are additional purchases you can make and stuff like that. And I find it much more, certainly it's just different types of problem solving, but I enjoy just creating a bespoke experience where you don't have to worry about retaining the player in your game, because that's how your money is made. There's just an upfront investment of their time and their money and their resources, which means that like the way that we get to design this player experience is like a lot more pure.
You're not spending a lot of time like designing alternate currencies.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, that's what I value as a gamer. And right. I know a lot of people love freemium games and absolutely no shade on that.
Sure.
But it's so much more concurrent now with like what my experiences were as a gamer. And like we had kind of talked about before, like this is why I got into games is because I love those kind of experiences that have been made and to be able to like finally bring that forth. I think it's like, definitely the biggest difference. So there's certainly some, you know, production parallels, but where my heart is now, I think, is a lot different.
Nice. Yeah. So you guys are in early pre-production.
Oh yeah,
your game, very early,
like 3 months in.
So
basically,
you guys are targeting a long time from now. I imagine that this is the easiest time, or at least the most fun time of game development.
The immediate skeptical looks on both of your faces.
No, easiest is the wrong word. Most fun time of game development is when you have all these ideas in your head. And no, you guys disagree.
I don't know. I mean, I won't speak for both of us. Lindsay can jump in after this. But I actually kind of, it's not hate, but like I find this period very challenging because like you're having to create everything. Mm-hmm. And like it's definitely a thing I've come to recognize is like I absolutely work best when it's like some amount of game exists. We know what it needs to accomplish. Put it in front of someone. Watch whether or not it does that stuff. Okay, there's stuff in there that isn't doing what we want it to do. Sweet. Okay, we can change it. Change this. Add this. Okay, perfect. Like, mm-hmm. that iteration is where I think I tend to operate most successfully.
Okay.
And when you have nothing to iterate on, you're just like, oh, we just have to build actually the world. We just have to make everything. So it's like, so much like grasping in the dark and having no real way to confirm that the decisions you're making now are the right ones. And so obviously there's a whole like, we'll just get as fast as possible, iterate, blah, 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 blah. But like, you know, the 1 week version of this game is so unevaluably bad that we can't do that. We just have to sink like a not small chunk of time to even have the barest skin and bones version of a thing that we can start evaluating on it. Uh-huh. And once we get to that point, that's where I do the best and am usually enjoying myself the most.
So is your goal like vertical slice, playable prototype, like see and then work from there? Like build around it?
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's more prototype-y than vertical slice-y, but yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely in the same place too, that it's like the really early stage is exhilarating and so much freedom, but to the extent that it's almost like nauseating at some points. It's like, it feels a little bit like you are designing a banquet dinner for an unknown amount of people with unknown dietary restrictions. Uh-huh. You think maybe some of them like tomatoes based on some stuff you've heard previously, and it's just like
Some of them are allergic to tomatoes and
will die. Yeah,
and
you're just like going down in this ingredient
list.
You'll
be arrested.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I think the stakes are extreme. Extremely high, so to speak. And it, so it's it was very intentionally a pun. Yeah. Sorry, everyone. Yes. So it's just kind of like you are just deducing like it is probably this, it's probably not this. And when you kind of get a better idea of like, all right, well, we are making Italian food for this banquet, like right. then that's kind of the realm where you start to funnel down what your decisions are. And that's probably the more fun part. But definitely overall, like game development is a roller coaster of like, we think we know what we're doing. Oh shit, we don't know what we're doing. Yeah. No, maybe we do now. And then you just kind of like hope we're the best.
Yeah, game development. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So we have to wrap things up shortly, but we know you guys can't talk a lot about what you're working on. Is there anything you can like tell people about where to find you guys, how to follow your work?
Yeah, definitely that. I mean, we both have Twitter presences. You can find me on Twitter at Nels Ormench, NelsOrmench.
Very cool. Where you will be tweeting about Mark and the Ninja all day, every day.
All day, every day. And then also, it's currently very bare bones right now, but we have a small website, caledonia.zone.
Cool.
CaledoniA.zone. You can sign up for a mailing list.
Zone.
It's a good one.
Zone. Hell yeah.
Nice.
That choice TLD. Mm-hmm. That's where ultimately more information about this stuff is going to get rolled out.
Cool.
And your stuff, Lindsay. Is.
Yeah, so I am on Twitter as well, like all game dev people, by the handle Apocalyns, APOCALYNDS.
Nice.
Say hi, and please sign up for our mailing list, because we're going to have cool, bespoke content at some point in the future.
At some point.
I only sign up for mailing it'll be list good.
Bespoke content.
I got some good news, buddy. It's coming.
No factory-made content for you. No.
Forget it. All bespoke.
So when are you guys planning an announcer? Can you not even talk about when you're planning an announcer?
It'll be a while.
Okay, very early.
In the future.
We'll have you back on the show in 2021, and we can talk about it.
Absolutely. We'll have much bigger beards then and be far more grizzled. Yes.
I would love to see giant beards on both of you.
Yeah.
Perfect. I'm looking forward to that. Yes. Thank you so much, Nels and Lindsay. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thank you both. Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.